the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello from London. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an amazing interview recorded with Jeremy Welch in London this week, who is the founder of Casa, where we discuss how Bitcoin changes everything. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So firstly, I'm going to talk to you about Dropbit, the best mobile Bitcoin wallet in the App Store. Also, they've got a very big announcement coming soon, hopefully next week. So keep an eye out for that. It's something that's super cool, something I will definitely be using. And also, they are sponsoring another party for me for Bitcoiners, which I'll be hosting in San Francisco when I'm out there for Bitcoin 2019. So the details for that will be coming shortly. But have you downloaded it yet? Have you played with Dropbit? What do you think? Let me know. I absolutely love it. It is by far the best mobile Bitcoin wallet I've used. It's got the best UX. It's just like a Venmo for Bitcoin. And look, we don't have Venmo here in the UK, but every time I'm out in the States, I'm at dinner, I watch you all with your Venmos. And this is like a Bitcoin version of Venmo where you can just easily send Bitcoin back and forth to each other. It's super cool. It's got amazing UX. You definitely need to check it out. It's available for the iPhone and Android. So head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. That is dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And my newest sponsor, Acointing. Have you checked these out yet? They are simply the best crypto tax tool and portfolio tracking solution in the market, bar none. And not only that, they've got the best price tax calculator in the market. And they've just updated the website and the application, improving what was already an amazing experience. I loved it before. I thought it was so easy to use, and now it's just gone up a step. So definitely need to go and check it out. If you're taking your tax reporting seriously, then you've got to try out Acointing. With their integrated portfolio manager, you can optimize your trades to ensure that you are paying the lowest possible tax. You can import your data from all major exchanges and wallet providers, and you only pay when you want to download your tax report. It's an absolute no-brainer. Check it out at acointing.com, which is acointing.com. That is acointing.com, which is acointing.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Jeremy, and this one, yeah, it's a monster. Jeremy is without doubt one of my favorite people to speak to, and I love everything he has done with Casa, recruiting an amazing team of people and building a great suite of products, and just not just great products, but really usable products. But that also comes back to his recruitment. And this interview was sparked by a tweet storm of Jeremy's predicting an end to the edtech market, and coincidentally he was in London, so I was like, come on Jeremy, we got to talk about this. I've previously worked in advertising. I've also written about the decentralized threat to advertising, how the model's going to change. So this was right on my street, and I was really looking forward to it. But while I planned for this long discussion about advertising and privacy and the misuse of data, this actually evolved to a much broader conversation about how Bitcoin could be a civilizational change for us all. So yeah, Jeremy was blowing my mind through the whole interview, and I walked away feeling like, wow, God. I mean, I thought I was bullish. I thought I'd been going down the rabbit hole, but I'm just like, I don't know. I'm just going to have to go a lot deeper now with all this. So yeah, it's very, very cool interview. Really enjoyed it. Totally blew my mind. If you've got any questions about it, you can reach out to me. Would definitely love your feedback. Also, just a couple of notes. I'm off to the States on Wednesday. I'm going to be hit in Boston, Washington, Florida, San Francisco for Bitcoin 2019, LA and New York. I'll be recording lots of interviews, meeting up with a bunch of people, and it should be a great trip. Hopefully I'll bump into a few of you while I'm away. And if you enjoy the show and if you want to support what I do, then there's a section on my website that explains everything. Just head over to whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section, check out my website anyway. There's loads of cool ways to filter the content. You can filter by topic, by guest, you can read transcriptions, got my video interviews up there. So there's so much up there, so go and check it out. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the interview. If you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. All right, Jeremy, how you doing, man?
Doing well, how are you, man?
Good, good to see you in London.
Always good to see you.
Saves me a journey. What are you here for?
So here for the CogX Festival,
okay,
which is emerging tech, AI, pretty big festival. I think they had 10 or 15,000 people this year, and just try to bring a lot of the major AI players and emerging tech players to London for a few days. So we were thrilled, very humbled to participate this year. We gave a small talk just about usability and about what we're doing. And yeah, catching up with a lot of friends here, some investors, some clients, but it's been great. Always good to be in London.
So I guess it's more of a generic crowd, so you have to take the complexity of what you're presenting back a bit.
That's right. And I think that, you know, we're at a point in the industry to where that's necessary anyways. We've got to get out of the kind of typical crypto crowd, crypto niche, crypto geeks, and towards the more average users. And so it's a great time. We've been thinking a lot about and spending a lot of time at kind of non-crypto conferences and starting to talk to non-crypto groups. Now, we, of course, love our core user base and our kind of core family, the Casa family, but it's no use if we all kind of stay in this bubble. We need to bring more people in. And so we're thinking a lot about that. And this was a great conference for that.
And you're saying crypto, but you're a Bitcoin-only company, right?
That's right. That's right. We are Bitcoin-focused. We think that, you know, we've long said that we were Bitcoin first, but we had a lot of customers that would ask us for help in securing other assets. And that doesn't just mean crypto assets. That even means, you know, information or their physical assets, asking us about OPSEC principles. So it doesn't even refer to other currencies. That's just data and wealth generally. And so we've consulted across just general OPSEC. We obviously have software and products specifically around Bitcoin, but we now have we've tightened focus. We made a very clear business analysis, and the cost of supporting anything else are too high, and they're growing. And the customer basis, you know, the long-term wealth and the long-term importance of Bitcoin is so high that it's just not worth our time right now at all to focus on anything else. A lot of the developments around Lightning, a lot of the developments around even identity, Microsoft announced their Ion product. There's so much happening in the Bitcoin space. So we're excited to tighten our focus, building a lot of integrations between the core products and expanding into these other areas like identity, applications, but everything, again, built on top of Bitcoin.
Obviously, read your tweet storm this week that was quite popular. Nice coincidence you're here in London so we can actually record this together.
Timing worked out great.
Yeah, great. And it's something that's close to me because I worked in advertising 20 years. I've written about...
That's right. That's right. I forgot about that. I worked in the industry for quite a while and we built some of the core tech around retargeting. I wasn't a founder of this team, but I was an early team member and learned a tremendous amount from the founders and that were kind of foundational to the company that we're building today with Casa. But I also learned a ton about that industry. And it's crazy. You know, most people, the average person just has no idea the depth of the data that is being sucked down on them on a regular basis. And you've seen that. You've been in the industry directly. And so, you know, I'm excited about this conversation because we can dig into a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I fell out of love with it. And I was on the digital side. We were a supplier, so we were an agency. And I used to buy two or three books for people when they joined our agency. And even though we were digital, one of the ones I bought was Ogilvy on advertising because I wanted people to understand about the history of creative, you know, the soul of the industry. And then and then Mad Men came out and I absolutely loved it as a program. But by the end of my career, we got to the point where everything was just about data and testing. It was just kind of, I kind of got a bit sick of it. But one thing happened when I was reading your tweet storm, and then I was thinking about Casa, and I was thinking, okay, I think I get what you guys are doing, and I can't figure out if this was the plan all along or this is an evolution. But to me, you were key management, and then you were key management but with a node, which I thought was a great piece of marketing but also a great way of self-sovereignty.
Right.
But now I'm starting to think, hold on, are you guys foreseeing the future private web, which is what I've always thought Web3 is, not this Carl Samani token based web. Are you foreseeing that and actually starting to position yourselves as a layer between the user and the internet?
Yes. I mean, the core of it, the long term, and now we can talk about this a little more publicly, but we foresee that people will begin to exit. They basically have been in these, you can think of them like fiefdoms, right? They've been inside of Google. They've been inside of Facebook. Prior to that, they were inside AOL. And now they're exiting and going back into the real web, and they have to deal with their own security. They have to deal with their own infrastructure. And Casa as a company, we started by understanding, man, there's a lot of security concepts that most of my friends don't understand. They're not going to remember even if I tell them a few times or kind of, you know, really, really spend some time with them and help set them up. They could make a mistake themselves. So there's a need for a kind of helping hand, a company that collaborates with you, that has a financial incentive to continue collaborating with you, to both provide recommendations and software around that security, but not in a way that undercuts your sovereignty and your control. And it actually, if you look at the, and this is in talking about cybernetics and systems theory and these kind of control loops, it actually forms a very tight control loop. If the idea is you pay me a flat fee per year, I now have an incentive to make sure that you stay safe. My business is dependent on you staying safe and continuing to pay a flat fee once a year. And so we the incentives align very nicely there. The more educated I can make you, the more secure I can make you, the longer I can kind of plan out and the more secure my revenue stream is. And so there is a very clear business incentive, but this business model is very different than a lot of the advertising business models, which are based around these very long control loops to where, you know, I bring you in, it's totally free, you use my product, we generate data, I sell that to someone who sells that to someone else, who sells that to someone else, and it goes all the way around this chain. And somewhere back around, it kind of comes back and maybe I take some more data in and, you know, we put advertising into the product, but there's this massive, there's so many hands in the pie, where instead of that, it's very simple. It's just our direct relationship here.
It's funny. I'm starting to see that the industry, I think, is going to go full circle. You know, we were talking in the car earlier about the Gimlet deal, about creating media.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to go back to a world of the importance of creative, because I think the access to data is going to start reducing.
100%. That's right. That's right.
And so I think the old school advertising principles are going to come back, which I think is super important.
Which is great, right?
Yeah.
Advertising is not going to go away. That's, you know, I think that was one thing that a lot of people misunderstood with this kind of tweet storm, is I made a point at the end that all this stuff will be reborn, but it will be reborn in a more organic, direct way of like, I really have to speak to the audience and I really have to engage them, and not in a, you know, terror or shocking way, but in a kind of much, much tighter connection.
Well, I still love advertising. So as I said to you, I love the Ogilvy and advertising book, the old school creative team. Yeah. We have an art director and a copywriter coming up with great ideas.
Right.
I think what I saw happened at some of the big ad agencies was the budget they used to have for like a TV and a radio spot and perhaps a print ad was suddenly getting split between social, digital.
That's right. Yep.
And then the creative teams were getting overworked because there was less budget. So the creative quality dropped. And then we got into this horrible world. And like the one term that summed it all up for me is programmatic. Every time I heard that fucking word, I was like, oh, where have we come to?
That's right.
But it was funny because about a year ago, I was chatting to Ricardo Fluffy Pony. And he said, look, the thing about privacy is that we all kind of want it, but we're all lazy. So we'll hear about our data being hacked and we'll hear about, you know, Cambridge Analytica, and we won't do anything. It needs to be driven top down by the companies. And what we've now seen with Apple and Microsoft is that they're essentially going to change the game.
Yes, they are. And even Facebook is now claiming that they're making a new kind of focus on privacy products, on heavy encryption across their messenger. They're still combining everything. And, you know, we'll see what their new currency looks like. But there are, you know, all of the big players are making moves in this space. And I think that, you know, they've done it in a public way, but for the majority of the business population, the investor population, they still haven't caught on. They're still not seeing it as, and that was the kind of core point I was trying to make, is that a lot of forces are aligning now. And I was trying to kind of highlight those different forces, and we're just on the edge of it. You know, this will still take years to play out, but what tends to happen in most systems is the feedback loop intensifies. And so although it starts very slow, it can pick up speed very, very fast. And most technology, this is a common pattern across all technology, most technology waves, they happen a little slower than people anticipate, but when they do happen, they happen very, very fast. And we're starting to see these edges of these large companies. Again, it's still a trickle, but it could become a flood very quickly.
I kind of can't figure out what Google's response is going to be to this, because they're the only ones where I look at them and think, you don't have a play outside of data.
Yeah.
And I just can't figure out what they're going to do, because I've tried, after I did my last interview with Lop, I went and got rid of all my Google tracking.
Yeah.
I turned off all my tracking on my phone. But Google ended up becoming a bit shit.
Yeah.
It was a bit pointless. So I had to allow some data back in. So I'm wondering what their play is going to be.
We'll see. I think that the, they have a number of tools. They have a search monopoly. I don't think a lot of that's going to totally go away, but it is going to evolve. The majority of their revenue has been from advertising for a very long time. And that will change. It'll change the culture. It'll change the way the company is formed. It'll change the priorities of the company. It'll change the revenue basis of the company. But I think the way to approach it, the way to think about some of these existing companies is their product able to be directly sold or able to be bundled in something? And if it is, you know, they may have a shot. If it's not, if it's something that users won't pay for directly, then there will likely be some other company that will start providing that product or service as a function of something they can charge for. So if it is security, if, you know, we're charging for security, we have an incentive to, you know, align and try to provide products for our customers. And we're trying to bundle more and more into the bundle. But there will be other types of products people pay for. Apple is a great example. You buy the phone. You buy the phone and you buy your service. Apple has search. They have a web browser. They have tech. They have very light ad tech. But for them, it really is about the hardware, and they can bundle more of these products in, and similar with Microsoft. So they're, Microsoft and Apple are really in the kind of strongest position here.
Right. Let's unpack this. Let's go for anyone who doesn't know the background. So obviously you put the TweetStorm out. You kind of started to look at some of the future problems for ad tech. But let's go back. Can you, for somebody who doesn't know, explain what ad tech is? Because you've worked in the industry. And explain kind of like the history from traditional print TV ads and how everything changed with the internet.
Sure. So the easy explanation is just to think about newspapers. Most people have a direct experience with newspapers growing up, no matter where you were in the world. And there was always, every city had a major newspaper, sometimes two or three. Classifieds, advertising. You know, there's the editorial section, right close to the editorial section, there's always a big chunk of an ad space. And then you also pay for classifieds. And a lot of people have taken out a classifieds ad at some point looking for something. Even if they're like buying a house or something, there are some legal requirements to list a classifieds ad in some of these newspapers. So that was the primary revenue source for most of these newspapers. The internet emerges, you now have all of these extra pages, and you can think of each one of those web pages as being a page in the newspaper. It's the same thing. I mean, it's just sourcing local information. And in fact, a lot of the earliest websites to grow were news websites. So they tried to replicate the exact same model. The newspapers had these large advertising divisions, sales divisions that would go all around to all the local businesses, some national businesses, and would sell in bulk. You know, you're going to buy the ad for these few months at a time. We're going to put it on these pages. They sell it in a bundle. And we have a certain type of listener, or I mean, a certain type of reader. We know that their general income, we know where they live, and we can, you know, you want to reach this type of person. That was how the sell worked, but it was all bundled. The internet comes along and they try to do the same thing, and it just didn't work that well, because now instead of selling a set number of pages, 60 or so in a newspaper, you're selling millions of sites. So you had a roll up. So you had companies like Yahoo. Yahoo's whole play was building as many different types of pages as possible. Then they had a common ad sales that would bundle and sell these massive bundles similar to newspapers. The big transition happened when you got programmers in the mix, you got software in the mix, and they said, we can actually scale this faster. We can scale the sales faster, and we can scale the ad serving faster if everything is just totally software. No advertising guy. I mean, you used to literally have an ad ops guy that would load the individual image onto the site, right? And now it's all automated. And so you had all this software that got built out, allowed the business to scale, and then that leads to these companies like Google and Facebook and Yahoo. Yahoo used to be the largest publisher in the world. In terms of pure number of pages, they had the most pages where you could place an ad. And you had these group sales, but now it shifted all to programmatic, and it shifted to, instead of being about, the big transition happened where it shifted from being about, instead of buying a property, what you would do in the last 10 to 15 years is you instead bought an audience. And it didn't matter where that audience was on the web. You wanted to buy that audience. Now, in order to do that, in order to track someone as they go between New York Times, Yahoo, whatever your favorite, whatever the major websites are, you had to cookie that user. You had to tag them. And that's why I was using this term bag and tag, right? you had to bag and tag users. You had to group them. And then that data sales became like the major push around the advertising industry. Tracking, collecting all the data you could. You group those users, you sell the users instead of selling the website. And that became even more scalable, even more revenue. And then we find ourselves in this current environment to where there's massive amounts of data out there. Every person on the world has some sort of profile. I mean, you think that you have some CIA or NSA database. Everyone has like a like the advertising agencies have more data on individuals globally than anyone else. And it's practically like an intelligence agency. And the problem is that that data can leak. The problem is that that data can be hacked, can be taken. And again, people just don't have privacy. And now the cost, the point of the tweet storm is that now with Bitcoin and direct access to funds and the ability to hold large amounts of funds directly, the costs to holding those funds, the cost of having that data out there is now a much bigger risk. Prior to Bitcoin and prior to holding a lot of this data and wealth directly, it's not as much of a risk. But now that's out there, you know, from an OPSEC perspective, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners, they won't post on social media. They won't post on, or if they do, they'll post 5 days after they've been in a place. General security practice, I mean, that's one thing we do. I mean, we're talking on that we're in London right now, but this isn't going to be posted for several more days, right? So
we're live streaming.
Yeah. Whoops.
No, I'm fucking me.
No, it's okay. It's okay. But I mean, you do it from a security perspective. You know, that a lot of Bitcoiners are already taking those major precautions. And that's just not a world that most people had to live in. And now they have the option. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to go this direction, but there will be, we anticipate that there will be more and more reasons for people to go towards this world because you effectively get superpowers, right? You can control your data and control your wealth. You can craft a life that, you know, you're not boxed in to one media property or one. You can read whatever you want. You can communicate whatever you want. And as a lot of the other platforms, you know, YouTube, these other groups are, other platforms are, they're blocking people not because a lot of people think it's just political. It's not political. It's they don't want any fighting on their platform because advertisers will leave. So their money dries up if there's a lot of infighting on their platform. There's of course some bias, but ultimately that's why the bans happen. And as that happens more and more, a lot of those users are going to go off and either create their own sites or create these smaller communities. And again, things are getting more private. The data is getting tighter and the cost, if you do get attacked, you know, the risk is getting greater and all of those forces are aligning. And then now we also have government. So we have GDPR, mm-hmm. But now we also have an incentive for governments globally. In the US, California is going to enact a privacy law. I believe they already signed it in. I don't think it's active right now. But you now have governments now that are also enacting this for their citizens and all these forces are aligning.
So what you're really saying is then with Bitcoin, people are suddenly exposed to having their wealth perhaps online or exposed to online or easily stolen.
Yeah.
Therefore, there's an imperative to protect your privacy. But there's not that many Bitcoin holders. So this is almost like the Bitcoiners are, when companies like yourself are kind of paving the way. Yeah. But I perhaps wonder if something like the Facebook coin will end up accelerating this requirement.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that... you know, a lot of people have had a lot of criticism about JPM coin, about Facebook coin. Ultimately, these all will just expose more people to life outside of your traditional bank account. And that's a good thing. As that happens, people will then begin comparing. Right now, it's you kind of have people that have cryptocurrency, period, and people that don't. And the people that don't, there's a much bigger portion of those. And now you'll have people that have cryptocurrency. It's just a question for them of whether they have Facebook coin, whether they have Bitcoin, you know, whether they have, I fully expect there will be, I mean, we already have the Petro. So there will be other nationalities that list cryptocurrencies as well. And users will have a lot of choice and that's a good thing. But as that choice comes out, they will have choice and some of them will choose to go down this path of holding their wealth more directly. And they will need help with security, they'll need help with OPSEC, they'll need help with the tools. And that's kind of what we're trying to do and why we're building Casa.
So the Facebook thing's really interesting because the first time I heard about it, I don't know about you, but I was a bit like, oh, all right, here we go. They're going to track all our spending.
Yeah.
But I kind of stepped back from that and said, okay, what's the big opportunity here? And there's a couple of things that crossed my mind. But firstly, is that it's going to expose a whole new group of people to the term cryptocurrency.
Yes.
And the fact that they're probably going to hold their first cryptocurrency, whether you believe it is or not, whatever, but you are going to be exposed to it. Secondly, with that, almost certainly at some point, you're then going to be exposed to a chart which shows the value of your Bitcoin or value of Bitcoin compared to Facebook coin.
Right.
And you're going to constantly see that the value of your Facebook is going down against Bitcoin. So you think, right. Oh, I might need some Bitcoin.
Right.
So that's a couple of things on my mind. The other thing on my mind is that as Facebook are preparing to release this and doing all their work in advance, I'm assuming all the hackers out there are preparing for the release and thinking how they're going to attack this and steal the Facebook coin. Can they steal it? Can they move it? Can they liquidate it?
Yeah. And this is, again, if we just back up from a systems theory view, the Western nation state banking system, the global banking system, has been through hundreds of years now of building to become what it is today. Hundreds of tests in terms of, I mean, it used to, we watch movies about it now, we don't even think about it, but robbing the train as a Western cowboy or bandit was really someone's living. That's how they made a living, is they robbed trains that were carrying wealth, carrying gold, right, from the Western frontier and the States. We've been through hundreds of years now to evolve to the point, and it's a very stable system. But the way that they've created that stability is by basically closing out a lot of the frontier. And now with Bitcoin, we have something that's pretty unique. And we view Bitcoin from this lens of, it's just a resilient system. The monetary benefit is kind of a side point. It is part of the core design that gives it that resilience. But the monetary nature of, or the, just as a, from a systems theory view, it is the most resilient system on the planet in our estimation. And so we don't know all the exact ways, but we do expect most computing, most social systems, most civilizational systems to eventually be dependent in some way on Bitcoin, just because it's one of the few things that you can point to and say it will be around. Now the price, it's going to fluctuate, but at least it will be around. And that's really important. Where a lot of other systems or companies die, products die. And from that perspective, again, just resilience of a system perspective, that's another thing that people are going to compare with Facebook coin, with any of the other coins. And then a lot of the attackers are going to be comparing that too. It's funny, if you look at a lot of the hackers, they immediately try to convert into Bitcoin no matter what they steal. And in some cases, they've attacked certain exchanges and the only thing they take is Bitcoin. Or that's, the thing they take the most, but
yeah, it's interesting. So I'm spending more and more time trying to look at Facebook, and it's funny. I flipped the podcast recently and said, I'm just going to focus on Bitcoin, but I think Facebook coin is going to be relevant, whatever it's called, Libra coin, because of the exposure it's going to bring to people. But there's a couple other things been crossing my mind.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you think about this, but I think the US government probably loved the thought of Facebook coin because essentially it strengthens the dollar globally. I could see certain countries where, say Argentina, if everybody's on Facebook and WhatsApp and they can access Facebook coin, why would they carry on using the peso?
Yeah. Yeah. I ultimately, you will see some alignment between governments and groups like Facebook. Now, the U.S. obviously has a regulatory capture on Facebook, with Facebook being based in Palo Alto in California. And it will be, everything will be used as a tool for the government that, the jurisdiction that's there. And so Bitcoin is in a unique case, right, where it's, and it will be both the one that's fought the most, although there are plenty of people in, at least in the U.S. government, that have spoken positively about it. They've actually found, there's plenty of corruption that they've actually uncovered because Bitcoin is easily traceable. And it is pseudonymous, but it is also, once you kind of know which accounts you're dealing with, they've actually kind of uncovered some corruption, which is interesting too. So I think you're right. I think that there's something interesting there. And do you think that, it's questionable whether, we already know that Facebook was working with some of the government agencies around surveillance. Do you think that they're already in their early building, right, collaborating with nation state actors? Who knows?
Almost certainly with the US government. I don't think you can launch a version of the dollar on a social platform globally with potential 2 billion users without having a conversation with the government.
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
But I do see a huge amount of benefit to the government. I'm more interested in what other governments are going to think about this. And actually, is it a good or bad thing? Was it good that their population will have a more stable currency to use? Or is it negative? Will that completely devalue other currencies?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question as well. I mean, ultimately, in economics, in political theory, political economy, there's a concept called the Triffin dilemma, which is the country that has the reserve currency, there is a trade-off between kind of short and long-term thinking about taking the right actions for the global economy sometimes hurts your local economy. But if your goal is to grow the reserve currency status of the currency, sometimes you have to hurt kind of local business. And this has been a well understood concept for a long time and we've had waves of different reserve currencies. But I think that there's something similar here where, you know, there are these mixed trade-offs. And if the US government is going to lose the tool of having the US dollar as reserve currency, there's this question of, would they rather it shift to China, or would they rather it shift to a kind of corporate coin, or would they rather it shift to a coin that no one controls? The interesting thing, I mean, Bitcoin effectively solves the Triffin dilemma because there's just no one controls it. No state controls it. And therefore, and there's some argument around, you know, where mining is. But if there is this balance, does the Triffin dilemma still exist, or is Bitcoin just acting in its own self-interest? And because there's no nation state tied to it, there's no issue anymore. So I think that it raises that point. And I think that other countries have already been dependent on the U.S. reserve currency. And so for them, it won't change anything. They'll just shift the kind of allegiance. But the biggest question is for a lot of the regulators and politicians who have been used to using this as a policy tool and now maybe not having that control, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting also when you start thinking about these things like in real detail. So I obviously interviewed Daniel Buckner recently about what's happened at Microsoft.
Yep.
I've been talking to a lot of people about kind of some deep, interesting thoughts about Bitcoin. And actually, Nick Carter put out a tweet recently. It was like, he said, the goal is not mass adoption. The goal is a better financial system. Okay, so we've got a better financial system, but we've also got the ability to create decentralized IDs. So suddenly when you see these arguments about, oh, I want to do peer-to-peer cash, oh, I want to do store wealth, it doesn't really matter. It's a whole global system. It's a whole change of the way everything we do.
Right. Yeah, it's going to change everything. And a lot of people, it's funny, there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley, I think, that are underestimating how big the changes are going to be. A lot of Silicon Valley has effectively become like Wall Street because they've captured, both through regulatory means and through scale, pure scale, they've now captured a lot of power, and they've just, and the people that have rotated in, a lot of the early dreamers and rebels have now rotated out, and they're either investors or they're VCs or they're just retired. And a lot of the people that have rotated in are kind of more common. They went to university, they went to business school. They're a little more stable. They're not the kind of rebels that that Steve Jobs used to be, right? Or that some of the early founder types are. And there's still a lot, you know, that out there. But I do think that there's this higher proportion. What that means is that kind of population, I think this is why they haven't fully grasped and have had trouble with Bitcoin. That this is a more of a civilizational change and a more of a nation state shift than it is just this single market is going to change. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of criticism saying, you know, again, that you guys are too idealistic or you're thinking about it. And it's a simple calculation that most of those VCs do, and that the market is so large, the impacts are so large, that even if we're wrong or even if the timing is slightly off, the upside is so big and the consequences are so big. And it's not just about the money. It's about the implications on our families and the way people live. The implications are so big that there is no reason you should be spending your time really on anything else. So I think Nick is right. A lot of the decentralized tech is going to be important, and a lot of the changes that are coming, and it is still a ways off. You know, we're still very early in the game, but the impact is just so huge, or at least the risk of that impact is so huge.
So I brought this up in an interview, a couple of interviews ago. There's this great book called Engines That Move Markets, and it's just got key chapters. You know, the invention of the railway, or the invention of the light bulb, or the invention of the telephone, or the internet, all the different things that fundamentally changed industry and the way the world worked. And I'm pretty sure they're going to have to reissue that with Bitcoin at some point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, there's an interesting question as to kind of what wealth is or what an economy is. And an economy is, and there's many economies. That's another thing that I think is really important to distinguish about, as a lot of people define it as just a single market for money, when really it's a lot of overlapping markets. Each city is a market. Each neighborhood within a city is a market, and they all have differing needs and differing desires, right? And so I think there's something really important as to asking this question of kind of what wealth is and what an economy is, because there's a difference. Wealth to each individual person is very different. You know, I don't know what kind of, did you ever have a dream car whenever you were growing up?
Yeah. My car.
Come on.
I'll get killed for it.
No, what is it? Let's hear it.
I've always wanted a Lamborghini.
Okay, yeah, Lambo. Man,
I've always wanted a Lambo.
Did you have a certain type of Lambo?
I mean, growing up, it was the Countach, right?
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
Yeah. Beautiful car.
I had the little Micro Machine version.
Yeah, amazing.
And then before I blew all my money on mining, I nearly bought one. But not a Countach.
Nice.
And I nearly bought just an old Gallardo. I was going to do it last year. I thought, I'll have it for 6 months, get rid of it, and get out of my system.
Get out. Well, win moon, right? Like, maybe we'll be back there. But like, you have these.
What was yours?
So it's interesting. I always, when I was in third or fourth grade and in primary school, I loved the Dodge Viper. Dodge Viper. And that eventually evolved into
Huge bonnet.
Yeah. And I loved it. It was a beautiful car, very powerful, very impractical. But I also had, when the R8 first came out, the Audi,
nice.
Loved the Audi R8. Of course I drive a very simple car and, very, very simple life today, but maybe one day wind moon kind of thing. But I bring the car up because it's interesting. Everyone kind of has, even if you're not a car person, a lot of people have. It was a defining part of most people's lives, and that may change because of self-driving cars. But everyone has this kind of car that was a dream car. And for generations past, they always had cars that were a dream car, that were kind of aspirational. If you go back and you buy that car, now there's a limited market of people that actually want that Lambo, and you can spend all the money you want keeping that car in perfect condition. But the number of people that will buy that is different. So the important thing out of that is, what is wealth to you is not always wealth to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something interesting about, you buy this car, you put a bunch of money into it, you maintain the wealth of that car, you might not be able to sell that car, right? You might not be able, no, you can keep it, and until the end of your life, you can enjoy it, and that's great, but you might not be able to sell it back into the financial system. And there's a question of like, what is it that actually drives the calculus of what is worthy of being purchased in the market and not? It's not just the fact of like, this person likes this, and for cars and for art and for, you do have collectors, that is about personal preference. Ultimately, it comes back down to typically cash flow, or typically this question of I think Peter Thiel simplifies it down to just doing more with less. So very simply, what technology means is doing more with less. You use less resources to do the same thing. And if you can find a way to do more with less, that's a technology, and that's going to attract capital all day long, because it's just, X resource in, Y resource out. And if that gets more efficient, and it's more efficient than the other alternative method, it's going to constantly attract capital. The Lambo is probably not the most efficient thing, so you might not be able to resell it. That's okay. You enjoy it. But asking that question and getting to that fundamental principle of just doing more with less. Now, if we look at Bitcoin, and there is this big question of its energy usage, but what is that energy usage compared to an entire nation state in terms of backing and the predictability of it, is much more communicable amongst people. It's much more resilient. Overall, I think it's going to be shown to use less energy or have less energy waste. And ultimately it's just an overall better system. And when you get into those kind of core questions of like what money is, what wealth is, and what drives the system, That's where I think things align as to we're going to see a lot of companies dig into this because it's a much it's just a much more predictable system. You either have to, if you're Facebook, you know, how many of those companies are lobbying right now the government and basically have a hand in terms of the policies that are being made versus Bitcoin, where anybody can make a fork at any time. You know, you can fork off for your separate group if you want to have more control. It's just going to allow much more predictability, much more resilience. And overall, a lot of people over time are going to be, you know, they're going to see much more potential in it.
Next up, I talked to Jeremy more about how Bitcoin will change everything. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So let's talk about BlockFi, the future of Bitcoin and financial services. And they've currently got two products in the market. They've got their crypto-backed loans and their crypto interest accounts. I am using the crypto interest accounts. I've had two payments and they're super cool. And also, they just announced support for the Gemini stablecoin across the platform. BlockFi interest account clients at launch will be eligible to earn 6.2% APY paid monthly with a minimum balance of 2,500 GUSD. And balances above 100,000 GUSD will earn a tiered rate of 1.5% APY. Is something I'm definitely going to be checking out as soon as I can get some time. BlockFi also offers GUSD and USD loan funding options as collateral for institutional crypto borrowers. BlockFi's USD loan rates start as low as 4.5%. If you want to check any of these products out, you've got to do your own research and then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. That is BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Okay, let's lastly talk about Kraken today. Definitely not least, love these guys. Love everything they're doing. Big fan of the company. And you know what one of the coolest things about them is as I travel to different cities to do interviews, I'm always got Kraken people coming out and meeting up with me and showing me the most amazing hospitality. And I think that's a huge reflection on the company, a huge reflection on their culture. I actually recorded a show with Jesse about that, discussing the culture he's building at Kraken. So you should check that interview out. But also, they are the best exchange for buying and selling digital assets. It is the only place I now use for buying and selling Bitcoin. I'm fully behind them, not just because they're a sponsor, because everything they do for the industry. And I'm soon to be recording an interview with Nick Pococo, the head of security. Hopefully that's going to be happening in the next 3 weeks, where we're going to go into detail about crypto security, but also personal crypto security. So if you want to join me in supporting Kraken, head over to kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N.com. That is kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N.com. It's funny you should say that, and the point I'm going to make now aligns to Bitcoin, but do you know I measure wealth now? I measure it in time.
Yeah.
So there was, somebody said something to me, I can't remember what it was, like maybe 10 years ago, and it always stuck with me. It was this saying that an inch of time is worth an inch of gold, mm-hmm. but you can't buy an inch of time with an inch of gold.
Yep.
So it just goes. And little things happen. Like the other day, sadly, a Tottenham Hotspur footballer, ex-player, he's 49. He'd just been to watch Liverpool Tottenham in the Champions League mm-hmm. final. He's the manager. I think it's Leighton Orient, just got them promoted.
Yep.
Cardiac arrest and died.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, he's 49. I'm 40.
Yeah.
If that's me, that's 9 years.
Yeah.
So that's on my mind. So I measure it in time, and it's, I want to do what I like doing with my time. So when I had my agency, I thought I was happy, right? But I wasn't really. I liked the fact I had a company and, you know, we were turning over good money. And I liked the feast of when we won a new client. Mm-hmm. But delivering it and dealing with clients and working each night really late was bullshit. I was overweight. I had a cocaine problem. Like, yeah. My marriage fell apart. It was bullshit. Life yeah. wasn't good. I thought it was good.
Yeah.
Now I value it in terms of time. I'm doing a job I love.
Yes.
Like my job is to sit here and have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
I mean,
amazing.
It's fucking great, right?
Yeah.
So then I look at Bitcoin, and the way I see Bitcoin is that if I think, like, say, for my time preferences, over a long enough time frame, Bitcoin should be buying me more time.
That's right.
And so I'm like, I do not want to sell this shit, because if I can get through another bull run, I've made it, right?
Yeah.
And I've bought time.
100%. Yeah. And I think so. This is a really important point.
Like, wealth isn't rich for me.
Yes, yes, but I think that part of the point that I'm trying to make there is that not all wealth is the same in terms of efficiency, right? There are lots of types of wealth. There's lots of individual preferences around wealth, but if you're looking at wealth, okay, so I've generated some wealth or I've bought some wealth. Not all wealth is the same in terms of efficiency and in terms of tradability. And Bitcoin has an extreme on both. It has, in terms of efficiency, because of the limited cap, because the predictability around it. That's another thing that people haven't quite processed yet. If the Fed makes a change in interest rates, we won't know until that exact day. But right now, there are deliberations going on at every Fed meeting, and they've been deliberating this for months and months and months and months, and they know internally what's happening. And there are dinner parties to where they discuss these things, and there is a circle that knows that. But for you and I, we have no clue. Mm-hmm. For Bitcoin, there is an open, there's open message boards. A lot of people talk about the toxicity and a lot of the arguments. These arguments happen in every other business, every other government, everywhere. But they just happen in private and people don't see that. Now they're happening in public, and any of the code changes, they happen in public. Any of the code reviews, any of the, even just the planning, it all happens in public. That predictability creates a level of the tech is already efficient, but it also creates a kind of communication efficiency to where, yes, the hard cap and the growth of the currency and the price of the currency and the deflationary aspect may generate more wealth that gives you more time, but that predictability actually also gives you more time, because now you can look out in the future or you can rather instantly know if something changes or something goes wrong, where in most jobs you may spend years, decades thinking, okay, this is going to work, but little did you know that some government official actually had some plan for some law that was going to kill your business. They'd been planning it for 6 years. You just hadn't been in that discussion. You had no clue. You don't see any of the drafts, and then all of a sudden it hits one day and your business is done and those 10 years are down the tube. That's what, again, it is the efficiency and it's the predictability, but it's not just about the price and the growth and the wealth. It's about the fact that it is more predictable just because you can literally go to the code base. Anybody can go to that code base. And that's going to create a lot more dependence on the system because of that predictability. People can make farther plans. And it's the, Eric Lombroso was making a point on Twitter earlier this week. And he was talking about what it would be like to have a kind of more stable, more predictable currency. And he's exactly right. It's like today we're basically just building on quicksand. We're trying to build houses on quicksand was the thing I was saying. And if we had bedrock, we could build a skyscraper. We could build much higher. We can plan much higher. We can build what we want versus having these these massive constraints.
I've definitely got to get you and Travis Kling together. I think you two you'd get wasted, but you'd have a great time together. Sure. You and him would get on really well from two different angles. Have you ever learned to code? Not like HTML proper programming.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I'm technical. I worked at an ISP when I was younger, and I ended up studying philosophy in school and design. And but I can. A lot of the earliest versions of our products I built.
Do you remember when you first learned to program and you're looking at code and you're just like, it might have not been the same for you, but for me, I remember when I first learned my first scripting language and I was just like, what the?
Yeah.
Looking at it for days on end, and then one day it just clicks and yeah. You're like, oh shit, this is how it all works. This is how it all loops. Yeah. This is how it works together. It just clicks. And when I've been doing this podcast, I've been veering around, people keep saying, you just don't get Bitcoin yet. And I've always fucking hated it when people say that, because I'm like, what are you on about? It's not about that. But I think recently I have started to understand what they mean now.
Interesting.
Because it's not about these individual arguments. What is the block size? Can I pay for a coffee with it? It's not that. It's bigger than that, right? It's much bigger.
Yeah, it's much bigger.
Like, Bitcoin's going to change everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it could.
I'm confident it will either go to zero or it will, change the world. And
it will never go to zero. I'll buy it all.
There you go. I'm ultimately any technology. So this is something that's just a kind of core point about science. And now we live in this world of a lot of scientism where people would just use it like, science doesn't say anything. Science disproves things. So the scientific process is just purely about disproving things. And any theory that is the dominant theory in a scientific discipline is the theory that has the least objections, right? Or is the one that has survived the longest, but it doesn't mean that it can't be, explained away, or there couldn't be a contrary point that emerges. And it changes too. It evolves over time. Like the material world evolves over time. And so we get emergent events, and we get new materials, new things, new cities, new people, new ideas. And so this evolves over time. But that important point is that any system at any time could collapse. It's not just Bitcoin, the US dollar. It's called the Ludic fallacy, right? Which is, Nassim Taleb uses the example of a turkey that, you know, the turkey, if you look at a turkey's life, he's just getting plump and plump and plump and all the way up to November. And then November comes along and, you know, see off of his head.
Yeah.
And if you think about the life of a turkey, there's day after day after day of feeding, of just getting plumped up. Life is great. And then all of a sudden it's bad. Any system could have the same thing happen. But again, the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that the instant something like that happened, we would know. We would know instantly. We could adjust the code. It's transparent. Where all of our other current systems are completely, we talk about Facebook being open, open data, open privacy, but everything that happens behind the scenes is completely opaque. Everything that happens in the government's completely opaque. You basically have to live and be in the social scenes of DC or London or Silicon Valley to really even know kind of what's going on. And it's because they talk in these back rooms and parties about all the opaque things. But now we have this system that's open that anybody can look at. And that that is something that has not been fully understood how powerful that's going
to
be.
I'm literally sitting here thinking, right, I need to go home. All that useless shit I've got in my cupboards I never used, sell it. Stack sats.
Nice, stack sats, yeah.
My second car that I never drive, sell it, stack sats.
Yeah.
Like, just get rid of this all, go simple life, stack sats, and build a future life. Because if you're right,
yeah,
fuck, this is huge.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. But it just means that, I think most people need to come at it in their own way. But that's the thing that I encourage people is it's not about, you know, Bitcoin will be slightly different to everyone. But you should understand that it's an open system that you can go read and you can think about and you can view. And there's no rules. You don't have to ask someone's permission to read this shit. It's on the internet. It's true internet in the sense that it's, you know, open source peer-to-peer. And from that perspective, it's incredibly empowering. And I think we're going to see some crazy events out of this. We're going to see, you know, some kid in India or something that, you know, learns and starts reading and starts contributing. We've already seen a lot of contributors that have kind of come out of nowhere and that weren't from the traditional backgrounds of a lot of the Silicon Valley kind of power centers. And again, I think that's one thing that a lot of Silicon Valley is getting wrong right now is they're assuming that their power model and that their institutions and that their rubber stamp is still going to be required. And it's just not. We're in this new world where it's not. And it's going to be a global phenomenon.
So what do we do about education then? Because this is so complex, right?
Yeah.
You've got to fall down the rabbit hole and you've got to do a lot to try and get your head around it. But what do we do about education? Because, you know, we don't want people to miss out. We all want our friends to get involved. But we all want to understand this and the potential in the future.
Sure.
And we kind of had this decentralized education at the moment where everyone does it in their own different way. You know, you might explain it in one way. I release a podcast. Castle will do their education on their website. You know, there's lots of different ways. How do we try and educate this? Or is it a case there is no single way of educating?
Well, I think this is the beautiful thing about it, right? Is that I think that the future is very bright for education, but I think you have to separate out education from indoctrination, right? Because historically what we've really seen in a lot of educational systems is it's actually been more about socialization and indoctrination than it has been about kind of true education. True education is about experience, it's about learning, it's about challenges, it's about stimulus. You're taking a system of a human being and the human mind, and you're applying it. You're applying challenges repeatedly over time, and it's like lifting weights, right? It's like the more math problems you do, the stronger your brain gets, the more it can do, the more languages you read, the more languages it can adopt, right? And that's true education. It's unguided. It's you're curious about certain topics. You're sucked in certain areas. Indoctrination is trying to shove a specific concept, series of concepts in socialization. It has been a part of university. And these are not necessarily, I would say that like socialization and some type of community bonding and kind of community language is really important. Like that's not, it's not to say that that's not important, but we've had this kind of forced system to where, in the US K-12 and different states, it's slightly different. But you've had this requirement. And that's going to change. We're seeing a lot of kids already, they're learning through Minecraft, they're learning through YouTube, they're learning through these other channels, and they're learning things that they come home and they're speaking some language or they're doing something, and the parents are like, well, you know, where the hell did you learn that?
Yeah.
So I think that the future of education is I think we're headed towards a golden age if this proceeds correctly, but we have to get over the hump of there are going to be a lot of powerful forces that are going to clamp down in terms of information resources and the process to get there. And you know, but again, being able to hold keys, being able to hold your own wealth, maybe there will be someone around the world that we have, you know, we have a very distributed team. We're going to see more of that. We're going to see people earning, you know, small amounts, living in, doing geographic arbitrage to where their costs aren't very high. You know, they're learning, earning a smaller salary, but it goes a long way in their area. They do the work and the company just doesn't care, right? And whatever they think, their politics, we don't care as long as you do the work, easy transfer, paying them in Bitcoin or something else. So,
all right, so when we moon, are you still going to get the Dodge Viper? Or have you got, got your eyes on something else? Because I have changed, by the way.
What is yours now?
Because of my age, I think I need an Aston Martin.
Aston Martin, yeah, beautiful car.
Yeah, I probably would never have one, but you know, yeah. If we did, that would be it now.
Yeah,
the DB11 as well.
Yeah, that's a beautiful car. I don't know. I mean, I do like, I still like the Audis. The depreciation curve has shifted well enough now that they're actually like somewhat affordable if you compare it to a lot of the kind of regular sports cars, the used ones. But I also like so I actually worked on a project several years ago before this company. We were looking at electric car charging, problems around that. And my thesis then, when I started that company, we ended up having some kind of political issues internally and with co-founders, and we ended up shutting the company down, shutting the project down. But we recognized early on that Musk was right in terms of electric cars. And it wasn't because of just the moral arguments of driving electric cars. You can actually build a better car, a safer car. There are still questions around, like some of these are lighting on fire. You have some of those problems with gasoline cars too. It's just like you get more headlines around the Teslas lighting on fire. But I'm bringing this up because I do think that we're going to see a lot more electric cars. I think that a lot of the petrol cars are going to get more high-end and more specialized. But there's a beautiful Audi e-tron. It's an R8. It's all electric. Those are beautiful. A funny reversal of that is that I think the car was called a Karma. I don't remember the manufacturer.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
It was all electric initially. Someone has now done a reversal of this to where they bought the company and they're now putting gasoline engines in the Karma. But there's going to be a weird kind of dynamic over the next few years, even in that space with a lot of electric cars. And the e-tron's beautiful. So maybe it'll be an R8 or an e-tron. We'll see.
It might even get to the point, though, with self-driving cars that my brother said this to me. He said, you might in 20, 30 years, it might be illegal to drive a car on the road.
That's right.
It's too dangerous.
That's right. Or I think that there's a higher likelihood that it will just become cost prohibitive from an insurance perspective.
Yeah.
So if you're, you know, you have the only people that will have cars, it's going to be like people that regularly ride horses today or have their
racetrack.
You know, yeah, they'll have them at a racetrack or their show ponies or whatever. And, you know, different type of horsepower.
Did you listen to Andrew Yang on Joe Rogan?
I did not yet.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not keen on his whole universal.
Yeah, you're
basic
not Yang
income.
Gang.
No, I'm not. But, you know, I'm outside of US politics and Bitcoin has made me more conservative anyway.
Yeah.
But he was talking about self-driving lorries and he was talking about it's going to be safer. You know, less people are going to die.
Yeah.
But there's a whole wave of people who are going to lose their jobs because of these self-driving lorries.
Yeah.
And then so he was talking about that and talking about the future and how automation and AI is taking so many jobs that people aren't really prepared for this. Like within the next decade, a whole wave of people could be losing their jobs driving taxis, driving lorries.
Yeah.
And he was talking about what we're going to do about that. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm wondering if there's like, has anyone theorized anything to do with Bitcoin with this?
I've been thinking about this quite a while, and truck drivers are one of the, globally, are one of the, in terms of just pure numbers of truck drivers, it's one of the largest jobs out there in terms of profession. And it's an interesting job because a lot of truck drivers, they own their own truck. They almost work as a contractor. You have a lot of kind of family-based trucking companies that run as small businesses. It's been historically, it's been a lot of, there are some larger players, but a lot of like smaller players and a lot of independent contractors. And in terms of affording the self-driving cars, the self-driving trucks, that's going to be a game of the large corporations, right? That's not going to be a game that a lot of the independent players can do. So it is. It's not just the individual drivers. It's a lot of the small companies. It's a lot of small logistics providers. That's going to be a problem. And there's a lot of, you know, for people going into that today, it's more of an issue. Some of the kind of pure logistics providers will be okay because they're just going to use whatever means they can to get there. But it's going to be a problem for a lot of people. And I think the Bitcoin, the application there is that right now we're in quicksand, as we were talking, and the dollar and other currencies are losing their value. You used to be able to buy a house for $20,000-$30,000, and a very good house. And you know the amount of money that you have to make now just to afford, you provide for kids, have a family, have a basic house is absurd. If Bitcoin takes off, you will potentially be able to make one major contract. And this is very theoretical, and it may not happen, but there is a case, at least a logical case, to where if Bitcoin takes off, you make one major contribution in your lifetime and you get one major payment, do one major deal, and then you are kind of set. You can go do whatever you want beyond that. And that's actually somewhat similar to the way the venture community and the startup community works today. It's actually the way that real wealth works. This is the interesting thing. This is why I think you have to keep getting back to what is real wealth? What is real wealth versus just maintaining some existing wealth that's not real wealth? You have this case to where you build a whole new company or you build a whole new technology. That is real wealth. The existing system values it. The existing system pays a lot for it and adopts it very quickly. You get this high scalability. And then these entrepreneurs and the early team members, they're able to go do whatever they want, right? So we already have a real-world case of effectively a deflationary asset that is stock. If they're not printing lots of stock, but right now a lot of companies are buying back stock, so it's not pure deflationary asset. It could be increased. You could increase stock. You do it every time you take a new round of dilution. But the entrepreneurs are always trying to get to a state to where they have enough cash flow to where they can cap it. They don't need to bring in new investors. They don't need to sell new stock. And the value of that stock rises tremendously while they've contributed this wealth. So we have a kind of model for how that would potentially work. And we could see, everyone providing their contribution, creative, it could be social wealth, it could be economic wealth, but that would be very interesting. So maybe we don't need all the truck drivers.
No, we've gone way off the agenda here.
Amen.
So listen, somebody said to me once recently, they said they envisage a time where in their house they can essentially have their cypherpunk box and it's going to be their key management, access to their Bitcoin, their Tor, which accesses their internet.
Yeah.
It's going to be everything in one. Could that be the Castle node?
Well, the whole reason why we're building in that direction is yes, like we do envision that same possibility, that same potential future. We're trying to build a kind of extreme case. There are several other great companies that are also building on this line. And I think some people have questioned why we help pump other companies. And we're thrilled that more people are working this direction because it needs to happen.
We all grow together.
The sooner it happens, the better. Huh?
We all grow together.
We all grow together, right? And the important thing is that the overall model grows and that this technology continues to grow and thrive. And that's what's most important to us. But yes, the possibility of that exists. We have to build it. We have to take there. We have to prove that it's possible. I think that, and the reason why we even named the company Casa, the approach around that, we've thought a lot. We think that a lot of these questions are actually going to come down to even potentially Fourth Amendment protections, that for the individual, if you're able to, there are a lot of protections around the home, around your kind of most sensitive data and objects, and a lot of even like driving your car now. A lot of police officers have been taking funds, and so you're not even protected even in kind of regular transport. But most homes are still under a special legal protection. So we think that putting the device in the home for kind of most sensitive data and other offices, other homes you can control is actually potentially the safest place. But you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. So that's the point of multi-sig and the key management portion being tied into that too. You can have the device, you have that in your home, but you also have the encryption is based more on multi-sig and on something that's more distributed and resilient than having just everything in kind of one location. Because a fire could take it out, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And you talked about in your tweet storm, I think it was in your tweet storm, you said about this is essentially the fourth wave
fourth wave of computing. Yeah. And we think that a lot of it's ultimately going to come down. The fourth wave is really about encryption and a balance. And Microsoft is like, I was really surprised. The more we started digging in and thinking about their Ion project, you know, Satya has led us a major change in the culture there. And he's talking a lot about what he calls intelligent cloud and intelligent edge and this kind of constant dance and a lot mm-hmm. of encrypted and privacy focused data. And that's what it's really about, is privacy, making use of the entire computing infrastructure, but having more control over it, having that data encrypted, knowing what the companies are doing kind of behind the scenes in those clouds, which we have no idea. We have no idea how detailed Facebook's profiles are of us, right? That's mm-hmm. that's scary.
Yeah, of course.
There was a report that they were actually going to newspapers around the country and actually like pulling newspaper clippings and actually associating them with accounts. There's all of this stuff that they've done that we just have no idea.
But they're tracking you through other people's apps.
Yeah.
You don't even have to have the Facebook app to be tracked by Facebook.
That's right. There's a company they acquired called Inovo that does a lot of kind of app intelligence. And I believe the WhatsApp acquisition actually came from Intel that they had, knowing that WhatsApp was growing at a certain rate based on this other app that was basically spying on all the other apps on the phone. So it's like, it's absurd the depths that you know, the system goes that people just don't realize. And I think that, I did get challenged during that quite a few times during that, my thesis on that tweet storm, but because we had this idea of privacy before, it hasn't been enough for the system to change. I think what has changed now is that the experiences can become more compelling. We now understand all the major problems in kind of consumer apps are well understood. So rebuilding those in a new architecture, we know what the incentives are. So we can rebuild and we can test new things. The other thing, though, is that, again, the stakes are very high. If I have kind of a lifetime of wealth potentially, or I'm now planning for a massive future, and I can plan for a massive future, and you're planning to get the Lambo or do whatever, whatever your plans are, you would do 10 or 15 years out, you are way more protective of the path to get there, of the data around your life, of your life generally, because you're thinking that far out. This obsession is starting, the momentum is starting, everything is getting aligned. And I think the spark is happening and we're seeing it in small, what's the quote? The future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. So it's not evenly distributed, but I think it could rapidly become evenly distributed if we kind of do our jobs right.
Wow, man. It's kind of a big deal.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. And again, ad tech is going to be in a weird space.
Well, like I said to you, I hope it goes back to what it was, where it was creativity.
Storytelling. Yeah. It's just storytelling.
But we need creativity as well.
We need community, right? Yeah. And I talk a lot about, social networks are not bad inherently. Community is not bad inherently. Advertising is not bad inherently. I'll say another one. And I might get reamed for this one, but inflationary currency is not bad inherently.
Be careful.
It's when inflation happens that's not predictable, that people can't understand, when their wealth is devalued without them even knowing about it. That's the problem, mm-hmm. right? Using a predictable inflation system, this is how companies work. Right? When you bring in a new investor, you inflate the overall pool, but the price of stock rises. And that's how a company works. So we use inflation regularly with companies when financing, and it works perfectly fine in those scenarios. But that's because it's very clear to every stakeholder, every investor, every employee, they know what's happening. When it's not predictable, that's the major problem.
Yeah, Jill Carlson said the same. She said the same to me when we were talking about Venezuela and she was explaining it, but you're not allowed in Bitcoin.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, you can make that statement because it's the beauty about Bitcoin, though, is because there's a hard cap, that makes it predictable. And that also means that the wealth is very clearly defined and you can't inflate it away. And that's important to have in the overall system. But it is still important for us to have companies that can grow and can shift their stock profile, and that will continue to happen. As long as you have that communication. I will tell you that, like, if you ever had some scenario to where you brought new investors in or you diluted the overall pool and there's some investor that didn't find out, they will flip their lid.
Of course.
And they will spread that you will never raise money again, mm-hmm. right? But it's funny that like that's the case if you're not kind of keeping your investors and stakeholders up to speed. But yet we do it all day long in governance. We do it all day long and undercut the populace in terms of their wealth and their savings ability. And you know, nobody says anything.
So everyone's kind of got their blockbuster moment coming now, really, where you kind of accept what's coming and get involved and you understand the future, the new privacy tools that are coming, the importance of Bitcoin, or you ignore it and you get left behind.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's weird. Like everybody comes in for a different reason,
mm-hmm.
but as soon as they come in, the rabbit hole is so deep that they get sucked in and it's hard to do anything else. I think that's going to continue. But I do think that no matter when you come in, the overall world, the overall systems, because we now have this kind of rock hard layer of transparency and predictability, other systems will, and that's the most resilient system, other systems will kind of replicate pieces of that. So even if you don't buy in early, even if you don't get wealthy off of coin, even if you will still benefit from the overall system being there in place. And I think that, you know, you are going to have some very wealthy people that come out of this, but you're also going to have a lot of people that their lives are just better. And that's important. And we can, you know, I was saying last night that there are still billions of people that are unbanked.
Mm-hmm.
There's still billions of people that have no access to the financial system. And we actually, there is, you know, using open source tech, using Bitcoin, we could
Facebook.
Serve. Yeah, well, Facebook
yeah,
coin.
But realistically.
I do think Facebook coin, actually, I do think that they are going to try to kind of onboard entirely new sets of users globally. And that is a good thing, right? But again, those people will then be comparing Facebook coin to Bitcoin and to their other options. And we now have a system that we can then take and bring more of the world into kind of a financial system. And that's overall a good thing.
I mean, these people are suddenly just going to have a wallet on their phone,
yeah.
which is going to have dollar, which they can send to anyone in the world.
That's right.
Instantly.
That's right.
And they're going to understand the value. You know, we're flipping back and we shouldn't really do this too much. But I do see certain governments might then start to block Facebook or have some kind of...
You might see some of that. I mean, you're already starting to see... So I will say that one of my bets is... and I have this saying internally, I haven't said it publicly yet, but bet on balkanization.
Okay.
Bet on balkanization. What happens is that when you have this kind of base currency that is very predictable, I can then be, you know, I could be a totally different person than you, but we now have a common language. And that common language is now not built upon our social status. It's not whether I'm wearing a suit and you're wearing a suit. That's not the communication. The communication layer is that I have Bitcoin, you have Bitcoin. You can look anyway, you can think anything, you can do anything you want. And as long as we come together and there's Bitcoin as the common language, we can do a business deal, right? That's really important. That means that I can, a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin, which means that I can begin to express crazy opinions. I can begin to, you know, I can live wherever I want to. It's not bounded there. And so I think that we're going to see a lot of cities, a lot of countries, a lot of, you know, as more and more Bitcoin adoption happens, as more predictable currency is there and it's rock solid, we're going to see more people, more countries kind of come out of the woodwork with their new cultures, new music, a lot of new ways of doing things. But what that looks like is balkanized. It's kind of fractured in these small pockets of groups. We'll see how it plays out, but I do think that we're going to get bands of Facebook coin. We're also going to get more forks. Like maybe we'll end up with a Chinese version of Bitcoin and the US version of Bitcoin. Who knows? But we are going to see a lot more kind of balkanization, I think.
All right, man. Well, I think that's a really good place to kind of wind it up. Okay. Just the last couple of questions.
Sure.
If this is someone's first time they've listened to my show and they're like, what the fuck? What would you advise them to go and do right now? If they want to get involved, they want to learn, what are the things you would say go and do right now?
Sure. So if they've never experienced or really thought about Bitcoin before, you can go to, so LOP has a fantastic website.
Yeah,
Jameson.
Everyone knows that.
Yeah. It's like lop.net/Bitcoin. But Jameson, our CTO, has a phenomenal website that just is a big compendium of a lot of knowledge, both beginner sections and more advanced on a lot of knowledge if you want to dig in there. We do have our kind of, if you want to dig into the tech and you know a lot of the basics, We have this, you know, $300 price point gold package, which really is one of the best deals on the internet. And it's more than $500 worth of kind of total product, but we were able basically through bulk to like bring the cost down overall. And so we barely make any money on this package, but we view it as an exposure piece. You get a node, you get a hardware wallet, you get multi-sig, you get our direct support. And a lot of people have started to explore. I mean, we were on tech support with like an elderly couple and somewhere in Switzerland, like Amazing. A few weeks ago. It's like, it was shocking to us, the adoption that we've seen. And we're trying to make it easier. So you can go to keys.casa to the website. You can grab the gold package, and that is, you know, an easy kind of template. And we are here 24/7 support to help you get up to speed on a lot of that tech and understand it, answer questions. And yeah, listen to more what Bitcoin did. There's a ton of great interviews here. So there's a lot to learn here too.
All right, cool. And just to close out, anything you want to say about Casa, what's coming up and how people can find you and keep up to date on what you're up to?
Yeah, so we have the Twitter account, which is where we dump. We're probably most active there. And that's just at Casa, HODL, HODL, at Casa HODL. Keys.casa is the main website. We have a blog there, blog.keys.casa as well. I'm at Jeremy R. Welch, so on Twitter as well and somewhat active. But I think that, you know, we have a lot planned this year. We're thinking about the kind of next wave and what that adoption looks like. We have mentioned publicly that we're kind of working on version 2 of the device, which we're excited about. There's some new applications there. We kind of announced this that we're kind of partnering and learning and supporting Ion, the mm-hmm. decentralized identity
wow.
project from Microsoft.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, we were in their post, their blog post, and we like the direction they're headed, so we're supporting them. We're just thinking about kind of what other layers we can do to build into the core node that will be built on Bitcoin as this resilient kind of core and root system. And so we've got a lot of ideas on that. We've been doing a lot of experiments, and you'll see we've got one surprise that probably be end of month or sometime in July. That we're announcing, and a few more surprises to the end of the year, but it's going to be a fun year. We've got the halving next year. Like, there's going to be some interesting price movements, a lot of crazy politics. It's definitely just going to be a very fun year. We are hiring too. So if you want to work in this space,
all right, man.
Let us know.
Brilliant. Thanks awesome. For coming on.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. So what did you make of that? Did it blow your mind like it blew my mind? Did Jeremy make you feel more bullish? Do you know Casa? Have you ever checked them out? You definitely should. Their products are amazing. Their node is so cool. I've got mine here, and they've also got an amazing key management solution, which you should definitely check out. Since deciding to go Bitcoin only on the podcast, I'm kind of going further and further down the rabbit hole, and I'm trying to think more broader. I'm trying to think of a couple of things. Firstly, how far can Bitcoin take us? What are the things it can do? But also, still in my mind is how we educate people, because I was with some people yesterday and they were asking me to explain Bitcoin, and I actually found it really difficult. Well, firstly, because they were people my son's age, they were people at the school, and they wanted to know what Bitcoin was. Trying to explain it in a succinct way is really hard, because what I'm finding with Bitcoin, it is starting to become so many things. But it is really exciting, some of the potential, some of the new things people are doing. And also, when I look at Microsoft's decentralized IDs and what Apple is doing with their new sign-in functions, seeing two of the largest companies in the world, seeing privacy as a tool for competitive advantage, I'm starting to see the connection between Bitcoin and our use of the internet and our relationship with the internet. You know, the internet has become this cesspool of hacks and data breaches. We've got Orwellian levels of tracking, and the freemium content model has really destroyed large areas of journalism. The whole clickbait side of things has just become, it's just kind of crap. So yes, this future internet where Bitcoin plays a part in changing the game is one that excites me. I do want control of my data. I do want better privacy, but I also want a better internet experience. I want better content. And hopefully, as Jeremy says, this could change everything, not only for the internet, but the way we interact with each other. What do you think, though? What do you think of these wider thoughts of Bitcoin being a civilizational change? Is it really that big? Will Bitcoin change everything? As ever, I would always love your feedback. Please do get in touch. Let me know what you think. And yes, I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you do want to get back to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. If you want to support the show, it's all up on my website. I'm not going to go through the list of items this week, but head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section. It will explain anything you can do to support the show. And as I said, I'm off to the States on Wednesday. Lots of interviews planned. A couple of really cool ones that have been in the works for a while, which is exciting. Anyway, if you want to reach out to me, get in touch. I look forward to hearing from you.